Hi friends, just a reminder that neither Jody nor I are physicians and none of the following should be considered medical advice. Also, in this rapidly developing situation, the best source of information on your community and the regulations and recommendations that apply is your local health department. If you're listening to this in the future, first of all, congratulations on being in the future. Second of all, just know that the beginning of 2020 was a complicated time. Now, please enjoy the theme song by Jonathan Colton. DNA, you're in my heart. DNA. Hi, and welcome to episode 18 of BioBreak, a conversation with your friendly neighborhood biologist. I'm Andy Walsh, and with me this week is Jody, my wife.
Hi.
How you doing? That good, huh?
Yeah, I feel like that's my response every time we do this.
Some variation of that, and then some chuckling. Yes, it's good. Consistency is a good thing.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably how we all kind of face this.
Fair enough.
And adding, you know, school starting up and school uncertainties and all the other fun stuff going on in the world, it's, yeah.
Okay.
Hard to kind of muster more than a...
Oh, that's fair. So you mentioned school, so we talked about school-related topics last time, and I wanted an update on something about that real quick first, and then you said you had a couple other questions that you wanted to talk about this week. So last week we talked about a couple of studies that were related to children and how likely children are to get infected and to spread the virus and all those kinds of questions. And one of the studies came out of South Korea. And if I didn't mention last week, I apologize. I'd meant to mention that that study, you know, was sort of an early publication. It was one of these preprint kind of deals. Hasn't fully been reviewed. It will be published by the CDC's Emerging Infectious Disease Journal later this year, but they've kind of put an early release online. And that was a study that looked at contact tracing between people in South Korea and who seems to have infected whom. And we'd mentioned last week, one of the findings of that study seemed to indicate that kids in the 10 to 19 year age group were more likely to infect people than other folks. They've since added some data to the study, some additional contact tracing that suggested that, well, actually, in some of the families with kids in those age groups, it was the adults and the children of those ages were all exposed at the same time. They all had a shared contact, as opposed to the kids in that group having been the first to be infected and then spreading to the adults. And so when they took all that contact data into account, now it looks like those kids in that 10 to 19 age group aren't any more likely to infect people than others. You know, there's still transmission at that age group. And so, you know, I think that's still relevant to the school opening question and how to plan, you know, if you are going to have kids of those ages in person, how to plan for that. And that's why, you know, as we mentioned last week, you know, making policy decisions is not just a matter of finding a paper and saying, okay, this paper has all the answers. It's taking into account the data and understanding the context of these studies. And is it a preprint or is it a, you know, peer-reviewed publication? How does it fit in with other publications on the topic to make the decisions? And that's part of why I think it's, you know, a little bit unfortunate that each individual school district is having to make their own decisions, because there's a lot that has to go into these decisions. You know, I can't even read all the papers that are about these topics. You know, and so it's a lot of literature for anybody to keep up with, in addition to having to take into account what's going on in their, you know, locally, what, you know, the virus spread and so forth. And so that's why I think, you know, it's better to be able to do this at a higher level so that.
Well, and I think kind of what we've talked about kind of in our own discussions has been that there's a specific kind of skill set that you develop as somebody who regularly, you know, reads scientific information and processes it and kind of works through it. You know, this is not something that, you know, necessarily any physician could sit down and read this paper and, you know, fully comprehend it and be able to make all of the decisions. But like, that there are, you know, data scientists, there are, you know, other people who, you know, have, you know, I guess, have a better understanding of how to kind of process and fit all the information into, you know, what's critical, what are the kind of the, you know, extra variables that won't necessarily impact, you know, the overall information. Does that?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, I think we've talked previously about the scientific literature as a conversation, mm-hmm. and that it's primarily a conversation among scientists in different specific, very narrow subfields. And so that is the audience that they're addressing first and foremost. And the expectation is not, oh, you're going to make big policy decisions based on this paper that I've written. The expectation is you're going to factor that into the research that you're doing, you know, the next steps of the research project, maybe funding decisions, maybe clinical decisions. If it is more biomedical or clinical research, it might be something that clinicians would take into account. But even then, clinical practice is generally not decided by individual physicians reading individual medical literature. It's generally decided by groups of physicians in a particular area, you know, oncology or a specific subset of oncology or pediatrics or, you know, specific subset of pediatrics and so forth, reading all the papers on a particular topic and coming up with some decision about what's the best clinical practice and updating that, you know, periodically as new data might become available, because we don't expect every individual physician to read every individual, you know, medically relevant journal paper. That's just not feasible. You know, many of them are very conscientious about trying to keep up as much as possible, but it, you know, there's only so much that any person can do. They also have to kind of spend time with patients, I hear, is a thing that they do. Yeah, so, you know, we'll continue. My initial vision for, you know, this podcast was maybe not to be quite so cutting edge and not talk about the latest individual papers, because that is where it gets a little bit more tricky and there's more potential for things to get updated and corrected. And, you know, we don't generally make decisions based on single individual studies, especially, you know, ones that only involve hundreds of people or things like that. But, you know, the situation that we're in, people have a lot of questions and trying to answer them, you know, with whatever data we have available and, you know, updating when relevant as new data comes in.
And the information you can take away from is kids catch this, kids spread it. Adults catch this, adults spread it. So everybody wear your mask, don't touch your face.
Sure. At a very high level, that, you know, that those are all valid statements. So do we want to move on to some of your other questions you had for this week?
Sure. I'm doing lots more reading of science-y things than I did in 2019.
Yep.
One of the headlines that caught my eye was, you know, Dr. Fauci, and you know, pretty much any time I see his name, I'm gonna kind of read what he's saying. He was talking about, you know, the latest information on the vaccine, and he was talking about how, you know, this vaccine wouldn't necessarily be, you know, completely, it wouldn't completely protect everybody from, and I'm knowing scientists, and I know how, you know, it is very rare that I found you to ever say something is 100%, this is always going to happen. I understand that, but it did kind of make me wonder, okay, how do we figure out vaccine efficacy? How does it compare to, you know, the flu vaccine that everybody kind of talks about, how, oh, I'm not getting the flu vaccine because it never works, but there's data that shows that it does work. and various other vaccines, like, you know, the measles vaccine or, you know, polio, those kinds of, so how do we catch that? What does that mean? All of those things.
Okay. So let's start with, what does that mean? So actually there are two terms. There's vaccine efficacy and there is vaccine effectiveness, and they're related, but they're a little bit different. So when we talk about vaccine efficacy, that is generally measured in a more controlled setting. That might even be, you know, for some vaccines, a challenge study where we actually intentionally give some people the virus or the pathogen that we're developing a vaccine for, if that's an appropriate thing to do because we have treatments and ways mm-hmm. to help the people who do get infected. But generally, it's sort of in a more controlled setting. And so basically we just look at how many people get sick in the group that didn't get the vaccine, how many people get sick in the group that did get the vaccine. Hopefully there's a reduction in the group that did get the vaccine. And we just calculate what's the percent reduction. So you might see a vaccine efficacy reported as something like 80%. That means 80% fewer people in the group that got the vaccine got sick when exposed to the disease than in the group that didn't get the vaccine. So to put that in numbers, you know, if there's 100 people in each group, 100 people in the group that didn't get the vaccine all got sick. Only 20 people in the group that did get the vaccine got sick. That means there's an 80% reduction in infections, or what they call attack rate. So that's an 80% efficacy.
And that doesn't, you know, that's not talking about it, you know, those that did get sick, how sick they got. You know, there's nothing there.
Right. It's not a measure of the severity of the disease. You can also look at that, and we would also hope to see a reduction of that even among the people that did get sick in the vaccine group. But yeah, that's just a raw measure of if you had the vaccine, could, you know, what are your chances of, it's not exactly a probability, what are your chances, but it is speaking to that question of, are you, how is the probability that you're going to get sick reduced? What's the reduction in that probability is a better way of thinking about it. Effectiveness is a similar measure, but now it's looking at out in, so quote unquote, the wild, right, where we don't know exactly when and where people are getting exposed. We're dealing with a larger population of people, and so they have a wider range of underlying health status and immune status and so forth prior to vaccination. And so we're assessing how the vaccine performs in that thing, in that setting. It's a similar calculation, but it's just a slightly different measure because there's more variables there. And so you might expect that the effectiveness of a vaccine might be a little bit less than the measured efficacy in a more controlled lab study. They're going to be related and similar. They're not going to be...
Well, and would the effectiveness change with kind of, like, could you, like, kind of with how we've mostly eliminated polio? Did we officially eliminate polio?
We have not eradicated polio.
I thought we were close.
We were close. That's a whole story.
Okay. But I'm thinking when they first started giving the polio vaccine, about the other one.
Effectiveness.
Sorry. That's okay. Too many words. The effectiveness possibly went up as more people had the vaccine. So there was less virus around. Like, would that number change?
That's a good question. And yeah, I would expect that there would be some impact in your ability to measure it, based on how much of the disease is circulating. And so that's why generally what you'll see reported is an efficacy value because it's reported from a more controlled kind of study.
Okay.
But sometimes we do measure effectiveness, or at least talk about vaccine effectiveness as a separate topic. Okay. And that's what we're referring to. Part of the big reason why we're using vaccines, is it's a way to get to herd immunity, without actually everybody having to get exposed to the infection itself. If you get a high enough vaccine rate that you have herd immunity in an area, that's going to change, you know, how the infection is spreading and the likelihood of even running into it. And so, all the people who get the polio vaccine in the United States, you know, they're protected partly because of a large part due to the vaccine, you know, provides a large amount of protection, but they're also protected from polio because there just isn't polio circulating in the United States. So that's what we mean when we're talking about vaccine efficacy and vaccine effectiveness. And it can be quite different. Some vaccines are in the 80s and the 90s percent-wise in terms of efficacy. Some years the flu vaccine is more down in the 50s, 40s. Some years, 40 to 60 is the usual range that it's in. It has been outside of that in either direction some years, but generally that's what we're aiming for. Or generally that's what we see. What we're able to achieve. That has a lot to do with the specifics of the flu. We've talked about, we made a lot of comparisons between the flu and COVID-19 and the coronavirus. We've also talked about that they're very different viruses, that you can't necessarily draw direct connections, but it's the thing that people have a lot of experience with. You know, it's a respiratory illness that people have a lot of experience with. So it's natural that people go there, draw those connections. But it is also important to remember that they're very different viruses. Our bodies react to them differently. They infect different cells and by different means and so forth. And so the fact that the flu vaccine only tends to, be at that 50 to 60% level doesn't necessarily mean that, oh, that's all the best we're going to be able to do for this SARS virus. We don't know what the efficacy of any of these vaccines are yet. We haven't done those measurements. We haven't at least seen those measurements. Something that might be able to, I would expect to see some, initial estimate for that out of the phase two trials that have completed for some of the candidates already, but those data haven't been published yet. So I don't know. I don't have numbers to quote yet. But yeah, that's something you should be able to get an initial estimate from those kinds of studies, and then another estimate, and even potentially an estimate of the effectiveness, because you're now talking about a wide population, from the phase three clinical trials that were, that we've now started enrolling people in. So we'll have to see. It could be that it's only in the 50% range, but it could be in the 80 or 90% range. There's no reason a priori to think, oh, we can't get that, because we do have vaccines against viruses that are in that range. We can talk a little bit about why the flu vaccine specifically tends to be lower efficacy and lower effectiveness. Partly that's because the virus mutates pretty readily. It mutates more often than the SARS coronavirus 2 that causes COVID-19. So that's one reason why we wouldn't necessarily expect that the two vaccines are going to wind up looking similar, because, a big reason why the flu vaccine can only be so effective is that they have to decide generally sometime in March what viruses are currently circulating, looking at what viruses are currently circulating to decide what to put in the vaccine, because it takes about 6 months to manufacture, so that come October-ish, they have a vaccine.
And you've said before, when we've talked about this on our own, like, they look at what's going on in Australia with the flu.
That's one of the things that gets taken into account, because the Southern Hemisphere is having winter, and so their flu season is over our summer. And so the respiratory illness and flu season is just kind of starting to tick up in the Southern Hemisphere in March.
So then do they never have a flu shot?
Well, no. When I say they look in March, that's for our vaccine.
Oh, right?
They have a separate process for the Southern Hemisphere, because they're on a different timetable.
Sorry, that's wild.
Yeah, and so, and different things are taken into account. So the WHO makes recommendations for the different hemispheres, and then individual countries can make their own decisions. So the U.S. vaccine might look different than the U.K. vaccine some years, depends.
Oh, here's a slightly off-topic question. Since we have pulled out of the WHO, are we still going to have that information? And you might not know that, because I'm just giving that to you right now.
Yeah, so it's unclear to me what all the ramifications are of what the president and other folks talked about when they mean pulling out of the WHO. We've talked about not providing funding. We've talked about some other things, so we might not report data to them. As far as I know, everything that the WHO does is pretty public, so I don't think it would mean that we would stop having access to whatever their recommendations are. But we might not be providing as much information about what's happening in the U.S. to them, and so we may find their recommendations less relevant. I don't know.
Okay.
We
can go back to that another time.
Yeah, I think that's a developing situation. It's best to explore it another time. So then we have to manufacture the vaccine over the course of those 6 months, and the virus could continue to mutate during that time. And then there's also some quirks about how that all process works. It might mean that we don't pick exactly the right strain every time. For example, the way that they decide which strains are similar to each other is by injecting ferrets that have never been exposed to any influenza viruses of any sort, inject them with a particular strain, get them to make antibodies, and then see which other strains of the flu those antibodies will bind to. And it's a pretty straightforward test. You put the antibodies and the virus and some red blood cells all in a mixture, and you see which combinations cause those red blood cells to stick together, to clump together in big groups. And what's happening there is that the virus is binding to the cells, the antibodies are binding to the virus, and if you get enough binding between all those things, you get big clumps of red blood cells. That is where the protein hemagglutinin gets its name from. So that is the, when we talk about influenza A, we talk about H1N1 and H3N2. That H stands for hemagglutinin. There are different major variations in the hemagglutinin protein, which is one of the outside proteins of the virus that allows it to stick to cells and get inside of cells. And it also has this property that, because it sticks to cells, it has this property that it, in this assay, it makes red blood cells group together. And so that's where that hemagglutinin name comes from. And within those different, so there's H1, H2, H3, and so forth, within those big categories, there are variants within that as well. And so the antibodies bind better or worse to different variations of those hemagglutinin proteins. And so they're trying to find a virus strain to put into the vaccine that generates antibodies that provide at least some binding to other strains that might also be going around, so that you pick one H1N1 strain that goes into the vaccine, and hopefully that covers against several of the circulating H1N1 variants in a particular year. They do the same thing separately for the H3N2, and then also for influenza B. And typically, a flu vaccine has a strain of each one of those, an H1N1A, an H3N2A, and an influenza B strain. And then more recently, we've started adding an additional H1N1 that's more like the virus that started going around in 2009, the swine flu outbreak, or the novel H1N1 outbreak in 2009. And then they grow the virus for the vaccine in chicken eggs. And not all the virus strains grow equally well in chicken eggs. And so some that informs which strains have to get picked, because you need to pick ones that can actually grow in the chicken eggs. And also, passaging them through the chicken eggs from one egg to another egg to another egg means that actually the virus will evolve and adapt to growing in the chicken eggs, because you're selecting for the ones that grow better in the chicken eggs. Those are the ones that are more likely to get grabbed when you go and pass from one egg to the next. And so over time, you can wind up with a flu strain that grows better in eggs, but is now different from what's actually circulating. And in the H3N2 viruses in particular seem to be susceptible to those kinds of adaptations, and to the kinds of adaptations that change the antigen proteins, so that actually what your immune system sees is a little bit different in these egg-adapted strains than in the wild circulating strains. And so the tendency is actually for the H3N2 strain in the vaccine to be the least effective or efficacious. And so those are some of the reasons why the flu vaccine can have a lower efficacy than you might like to see, or that you might like to hear. Good news is that we're not growing. We're not growing the SARS coronavirus 2 vaccine in chicken eggs.
Okay.
Some of the vaccine candidates, for example, the Moderna one that we've talked about that's already in phase 3 clinical trials, that's an RNA vaccine. It's actually injecting RNA into your body, and then your body is making the proteins that your immune system will react to. It's not making a whole virus, it's just making the spike protein. But all of that is happening inside your body. So now you don't have to worry about any sort of adaptations to cultures or chicken eggs or any of these kinds of things we have to do in the lab to make it grow in the lab, because it's growing inside of your body. And so your immune system is reacting to the exact same version of the protein that your body is going to make if you get infected with the virus itself. And so that's another reason why I might expect that this vaccine will have a higher efficacy than the flu vaccine.
And they've talked about this. While it still mutates, it's not mutating as fast as the flu virus tends to.
Correct. Its mutation rate is slower. It has a larger genome, and those two things tend to go together. Mostly because thanks to some work in the early 20th century, came to understand that if something mutates too quickly, it will just kind of lose... will lose the ability to be coherent and to maintain any sort of integrity to its replication and so forth. And so there has to be some balance between the mutation rate and the genome length. And the longer your genome, the lower the mutation rate needs to be, because otherwise if you have a high mutation rate, you'll just accumulate a lot of errors each time you make a copy of that genome. And so there is a balance there that all living things have to strike. And viruses are particularly kind of at the edge of that because they tend to mutate more often, and they have much, you know, they have a significant variability in the size of their genomes. Actually, there's a lot of variability in the size of the genomes in all life, including viruses. And so, yeah, different viruses have different mutation rates, partly because of that need to account for the length of their genomes. So the SARS coronavirus 2 has a more complex genome with more proteins and just a longer overall size than the flu. And so to be long-term competent, it needs to have a lower mutation rate.
All right. So get your flu vaccine and don't be... This vaccine is likely going to be... The COVID-19 vaccine is going to likely be a good thing.
There are reasons to expect that it will be different than the flu vaccine, and we have to do the work to see exactly what the numbers are, and that's why we're doing these phase 3 trials. That's how we get those numbers. It's also how we get a better sense of, you know, the side effects and the risks, you know, associated with the vaccine and so forth. And so that's why doing all those different phases is considered necessary to decide whether a vaccine is safe enough and effective enough to license. Right? We're not just asking, is it safe to give to people? Because if it doesn't work, then it doesn't really matter whether it's safe or not. And the more effective it is, the better that is to getting towards that herd immunity. Right? So if a vaccine, and that's one of the challenges why we still have the flu every year, and why we can't develop herd immunity to the flu, why we don't develop herd immunity to the flu in any given flu season, because a lot of people have to get a vaccine that's only has 50% efficacy to reach that herd immunity. A lot more people than if it was 95% effective or whatever. And the uptake of the flu vaccine just isn't that high. We could get it that high, right? More people could get the flu vaccine than currently do, but just the pragmatic reality is that at the current moment, not enough people get the flu vaccine at that level of efficacy to develop herd immunity in any given season. There is a relationship there, because herd immunity, you know, when we talk about maybe needing 60 or 70%, and that's still an estimate, we don't know exactly what we need for this virus, but that's a number that's gone around quite a bit, and that has to do with that R0 number. But if the vaccine is only has a 50% efficacy, then you have to get 60 to 70% of the people to actually develop the proper immune response, which means you need more than 60 to 70% to actually get the vaccine, because not everyone who gets the vaccine is going to develop that immune response. If it's closer to, you know, 80, 90, 95%, then a 60 to 70% of the population getting that vaccine gets you closer to that herd immunity. Again, the actual right numbers for this virus may be different as we learn more, but just so that you have a sense, so we're talking about some concrete numbers, that's what we'd be looking at.
Well, so you were talking about, you know, going through the trial process and kind of then testing whether it's, you know, effective. The other big story this week was that Russia developed their vaccine, they're not doing the phase 3 trial, so to speak. They've started giving their vaccine candidate to their healthcare workers.
They've approved a vaccine, or license a vaccine, the equivalent, as I understand it, and now I'm going by, you know, journalism reporting and not scientific literature. But as I understand it, based on the news reporting, something equivalent to, in the U.S., the FDA licenses vaccines. And so something equivalent to that in Russia has licensed this vaccine to be used. Not sure if they've actually started to administering it or if they plan to soon. But the announced plan has been that healthcare workers and teachers would be among the first people to receive it, with an eventual plan of administering it more widely, making it more widely available across the country later this fall. I think that, you know, that's a prioritization for obvious reasons. I think they're also, you know, there's a manufacturing scale up issue there. And so they don't have, you know, the millions and millions of doses of vaccine that they would need to give it to everybody in Russia today. And so they're, that's how they've chosen to prioritize who gets it. But yeah. So, you know, the way I look at that is that they've effectively decided to do a phase three trial among, you know, the healthcare workers and teachers that are getting the first rounds of doses, and not exactly in the same design kind of way. But it's effectively going to function as a phase three trial in the sense that if some more rare side effects exist, and, you know, they'll show up once they start giving them to, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of teachers and healthcare workers that wouldn't have shown up before. And, you know, presumably they'll start to get a sense over time of, you know, how many of those folks subsequently develop infections and whether, you know, how effective it is. But you're not getting the gold standard test of a double-blind randomized trial, which is what you normally have in a phase three setting. And so, you know, basically these folks are getting a vaccine where, you know, there has been some study done on it. I haven't seen individual publications about it, but, the, you know, they have done some phase one and I believe phase two trials, and they feel that they can go forward based on what they've seen there. But the, you know, the reason why we kind of do these different scaling up, we start with tens or, you know, 100 or 200 people in the phase one, and then a few hundred to maybe a thousand or so people in phase two, and then tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, is you want to see, okay, if there's a side effect that happens one out of two people, you don't want to give it to 100,000 people and have 50,000 people develop that side effect. You want to you learn that at this, you know, at a scale of tens or 100 people. And then, it, you know, so you now, it, and if you don't see side effects at that point, well, okay, then they're rarer than one in 100. You move to maybe a few hundred or 1,000 people. Okay, well, it's going to be rarer than one in 1,000. And so you, by scaling up, you're kind of ruling out the possibility of side effects of a certain frequency.
As they scale up and as they kind of like take in or kind of have more of an understanding of what potential side effects are, I'm assuming that the people are kind of under doctor's care, that they can be ready to treat, you know, potential like serious side effects that could happen.
You mean in these clinical trials?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. There's follow-up on those folks more than you would normally, you know, yeah. When you go and get the flu vaccine at Walgreens or whatever, you're not then enrolled in some kind of follow-up.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're in one of these trials, absolutely, you know, if you develop the illness, they provide medical care and so forth. And, you know, especially in the challenge studies, but, you know, often there'll be some kind of care that comes with being part of these studies. And, you know, because we're asking people to take on the risk of trying something unknown for the benefit of the rest of us. And then, you know, and also just they're generally following up on what is the health of these people. You know, how are their immune system responding? You know, what is their general reaction to the virus and so forth? Yeah, so, yeah, if you develop side effects, and certainly there are some things that develop, you know, some allergic reactions or whatever that can develop very quickly, and so you would see that potentially even at the time of administration.
And this is what's going on, like, for many countries around the world. They're all working on developing their own vaccine. I'm guessing because you've talked about how there are lots of candidates for vaccines, but this is one of those instances where it's not going to be one country that's going to be able to supply the entire world with a vaccine. And this is where having, some of our more, I guess, well-off countries will be able to take care of some of the ones. I'm sure there are countries that don't necessarily have the means to be able to necessarily create and develop and manufacture a vaccine. So there's going to have to be kind of a global effort.
Yeah, ultimately, these vaccines are not, hopefully not national property. And so every country has to develop their own. It's certainly not how we've done vaccines in the past. Yeah, so there are, 170 some odd polio vaccines or chickenpox vaccines. You know, we generally only develop one or two. This is kind of an extraordinary situation in which we're trying to get one as quickly as possible, which means we're trying a bunch of different things in parallel to see, in the hopes that at least a couple of them will work. And you know, hopefully a lot of them will work so that different manufacturing processes can be used to scale up enough doses in a short period of time, you know, so that, you know, you've got some of these RNA-based vaccines and some of these virus vector vaccines we've talked about with the measles vector, the adenovirus vector, or just, you know, manufactured proteins, like the one vaccine candidate we talked about that uses microneedle injections. You know, they're growing the protein and then just delivering the spike protein as part of the vaccine. And so all these different styles of vaccines have different manufacturing pipelines. And so by having more than one that works, that would be great, because then, you know, different pipelines that have different materials that go into them working it at the same time. So that's why we have such a massive, you know, parallel effort across all these different countries. But yeah, hopefully, you know, and there are questions about, you know, who gets it first and how, you know, a vaccine developed in the U.S. will be available around the world, or how a vaccine developed in, you know, the U.K. or Russia or any of these places will be available around the world. But generally speaking, yeah, we sell these things globally.
But this isn't something that we're all competitive on. This is a global group project, and the more people, we want Russia's vaccine to succeed, because then there is a segment of the population that is no longer going to spread the virus. And, you know, with how connected our society is, you know, the more people who can be vaccinated against this, the less that it will spread. And so it's like, we all want to win in the end.
Yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, I don't want the, you know, this Russian vaccine situation to turn out poorly. I don't have all the information to know what their decision was based on. You know, there have been different questions raised about political pressure and so forth that I don't have the knowledge or the expertise to be able to comment on. But, you know, just generally speaking, yeah, I don't want Russian people to get sick because, you know, the vaccine didn't work. I want the vaccine to work. I want everybody's vaccine to work, mm-hmm. And to work well and, you know, safely and, you know, a high level of efficacy. Because you're exactly right. The more people that have a vaccine dose that works, the less their opportunity there is to spread to the rest of us.
And the closer we are to getting back to pre-2019.
Yeah.
We'll go back and we'll do this year over.
You know, and again, there have been some questions raised about whether everybody is playing equally fairly, you know, in this global challenge and so forth. But certainly that's the ideal, and is that we're all collaborating and sharing and so forth. And that's why it's important to publish these results of these different trials so that everybody can look at the data and see, you know, because it probably what's going to come down to is some of these vaccine candidates may work better than others. And we won't, you know, we want to find that out quickly, and we want to find that out so that we have time to make a informed decision between them and not just kind of have to go with the first one that comes along.
Could there be a factor of some candidates might work better on different population groups? Or is that not necessarily how our bodies work?
It's entirely possible that... Your immune system has sort of a built-in repertoire, and different people's immune systems are different. And so they have slightly different repertoires, especially on the T cell side, but also to some extent on the antibody side from the B cells. And so it's possible that there could be certain kinds of vaccines that would work better for some people based on their immune system profile than others. I don't know how often we've looked for that sort of thing in the past, because generally we're not developing hundreds of vaccine candidates, mm-hmm. you know, all at once for something. And there's generally not the, you know, that's a pretty detailed study that you have to do to be able to answer that question. So I don't know if we'll ever get to that point, but to be able to know that and to say, okay, you should get this vaccine and you should get that vaccine. But that certainly biologically plausible that there could be some differences in how people react to a given vaccine versus another one.
It just made me wonder with how different people are reacting to the actual virus. Like,
yeah, that
just seemed like some kind of connection there.
Yeah, and that has been that has been raised as a possibility, as a possible explanation for some of the differences between people's different reactions, is that they went into it with a different immune system profile that meant that they were better able or less able to fight off the infection to begin with.
So that seems like a good segue to the other thing that, or one of the other things that I read this week, talking about, I guess the researchers have been looking at what exactly is going on. They're still trying to figure out what exactly is going on with our immune systems, with the virus, and how we're responding. And it looked like there was an article in the New York Times that was talking about how it seems to be that there is some kind of breakdown in communication between what cells are being deployed to fight the virus and what cells are being deployed in other parts of the body, I guess. And this is where you step in and kind of explain this in the correct way, because...
So the New York Times article was summarizing, looked like three different immunology papers that looked at basically how the immune response proceeds with a SARS coronavirus 2 infection, and trying to find some correlations between what's going on with the immune system at different times and the ultimate outcome for the patients. So looking at patients with mild to moderate disease, patients with severe disease, and comparing how their immune systems responded and comparing that to people who didn't have the infection at all and what their immune system is doing at any given time.
And from the explanation that I was reading, it was looking like one thing that is happening is that your body kind of has cells that indicate that there's a foreign body in there, there's a virus in there, and then deploys cells to then eliminate the virus. But it's looking like that in some responses, they know that there is something in there, but they can't find it in some cases.
So talking about immunology a little bit. So we have what we call the innate immune response and the adaptive immune response. The innate immune response is the first thing that kicks in. And that responds to more general signals. Certain kinds of bacterial infections, there are things that a lot of different bacteria have in common. And so the innate immune system can recognize those because it's just sort of a generic feature of either many or most bacteria. There are certain features of many viruses, such as double-stranded RNA is something that if you see that floating around, most likely that's because of a viral infection, because our bodies don't generally tend to make a whole lot of double-stranded RNA and certainly don't have a lot of it circulating, free in the bloodstream. So there are some signals like that that the innate immune response is looking for that just kind of generically say, yeah, there's something here that isn't normally here that doesn't belong. Let's start reacting. And so that can cause things like inflammation and fever and so forth as your body tries to start to react to whatever is going on. And then over time, those cells that comprise the innate immune system can also recruit cells of the adaptive immune system to basically develop a more tailored response to whatever specific pathogen is going around. And so there are chemicals that those cells use to communicate called cytokines. We talked about a cytokine storm as being a indicator of a negative outcome for patients with more serious disease, or something correlated with more serious disease. And that's basically their immune system is sending out lots and lots of signals and never really kind of turning down the volume as there's a response. So they use these cytokines as one of the ways to recruit cells of the adaptive immune response to say, hey, there's something here that needs to be that needs a more specific kind of reaction. And over the course of an infection, different cytokines can be detected as different cells respond in different ways, and there's positive and negative feedback so that the immune system doesn't kind of run out of control. So what they're reporting in these papers is that patients with more severe illness have different patterns of communication, different profiles of cytokines showing up at different times in both in the types that are happening and the quantities that they're seeing, which leads to different cell types being proliferated at different times. And, you know, that can lead to differences in inflammation patterns. That can lead to differences in things like organ damage. You know, the immune system, the cells of the immune system, part of their job is to go into the parts of your body where the infection is and get rid of it. And sometimes that can mean killing your own body cells if they're infected. And if that gets out of control, if that happens too much, that can, you know, cause organ damage and so forth. And that may be one of the reasons for severe illness is that the, you know, the damage that the immune system is doing to your body, and maybe why there are such wide ranges of symptoms and, you know, different parts of the body that are affected, because in this person, you know, the immune system targeted this organ, and in that person, the immune system targeted a different organ.
And that could be why, like, when they're talking about these kind of underlying conditions, you know, things like, you know, diabetes and some of these other things, there's already an issue with, you know, infection and inflammation and body, your immune system trying to manage, you know, different things that are already going on in the body. And then adding this virus into the mix, it just becomes a lot.
Yeah, so inflammation is associated with some of these other underlying conditions that seem to be risk factors. Yeah, and so that may be part of it. And the adaptive immune response has a couple of different variations depending on what it is targeting. There's what they call type 1, which is more the typical response for viral infections. There's type 2, and there's type 3, which are more typical for things like parasites and then funguses. Type 2 is also associated with like allergic reactions and inflammation of, you know, some kinds of autoimmune diseases and so forth, or things like diabetes. And so if your immune system has more of a type 2 response, then it's less well equipped to fight off a viral infection like this one. And so that may be one of the indicators of severe disease, is that the immune system goes down the wrong path and develops more of a type 2 response. And patients with these underlying conditions that are already kind of skewed in that direction may be more susceptible to that. There may also be some indication that the virus itself, some of these proteins we talked about, that it has a larger genome, more complex than the flu, it makes more proteins. Some of those proteins may be involved in tinkering with the immune reaction so that it doesn't target the virus itself and sort of goes off in the wrong direction. Not sure, but that would be one explanation for why the immune system is responding the way it does to this virus and not in the most optimal way for all patients. You know, I've kind of speaking in generalities, the results of these papers are very specific. We talked last week, I said that the papers we were talking about last week were pretty readable and that anybody might be able to go and take a look. These immunology papers are very technical, very challenging to read. I was looking at them. I did not, you know, get through them in all the detail and appreciate all the details that were coming out of them myself. I'm a little rusty on reading those kinds of papers. Not to say you shouldn't take a look at them, but, you know, just be aware that they are a little bit more detailed. A lot of these, for whatever reason in immunology, a lot of the proteins that they're looking at, so they identify different cell types of the immune system by the proteins that are on the outside of them. And a lot of these proteins just have kind of letter number names like CD4 and CD8, different things. So they can be a little bit intimidating until you get comfortable with just the different names. It's a lot to keep track of that doesn't stick readily in the mind because they're not the kind, you know, they're not words that we're used to reading.
I stuck with just the New York Times article.
Yeah, that's fair. I did want to mention briefly just the general technique, because I do think that the methodology is kind of interesting. So what they're doing to study the immune reaction is using a technique called flow cytometry. And this is something that I've been using in immunology for a long time. When I was in grad school, you know, it was a main technique in immunology. And basically they take the cells take a blood sample or other samples, and they take the cells from that and suspend them in a solution in such a way that they can then feed them through a system and look at cells individually. And they can put different fluorescent markers that bind to specific proteins on the outside of these cells and see which proteins are being expressed by which cells and which combinations of proteins. So CD4 and CD8 are one of the big ones. those are expressed by different kinds of T cells. And so when we talk about like helper T cells and killer T cells, that's how those are differentiated based on those CD4 and CD8 proteins on the outside. And there are hundreds of these proteins now that we understand play a role in differentiating different kinds of immune system cells.
When you talk about a protein being expressed, what does that mean?
Yeah, okay, sorry. So your genome has genes for hundreds of thousands of proteins. Any given cell at any given time is not making all of those proteins. It's making some of them, and it's taking the DNA of that gene, making an RNA copy of that subset of the genome, just a little bit of the DNA that corresponds to a single gene, makes an RNA copy of that. That goes outside the nucleus to the cytoplasm, where it meets up with a ribosome and gets translated into a protein. So the sequence of the RNA dictates what sequence of amino acids get incorporated into the protein to make a specific protein. And then, so any protein that gets made by a cell, the one verb for that is expressing it.
So trying to kind of think of it like metaphorically, I guess, could it be like if you're, you know, making homemade pasta and you choose to make like spaghetti or rigatoni, like it's all made from like the same group, but like the different kinds, would that be kind of similar?
That's an interesting analogy. I'm getting a little hung up on it because the difference between the different kinds of pasta is just the shape. Okay. And they're all the
proteins
same ingredients.
Are a little bit more.
Yeah, they're a little bit more differentiated. You can think of it maybe more in terms of, you're in the kitchen, you maybe have, you know, a bunch of different ingredients. You can make different foods out of it, right? So pasta might be one food, you know, even just like flour, water, sugar, right? There are different combinations of those
things. Or could it be more like, okay, pizza dough versus pasta versus bread versus, I don't know. I'm
sure,
trying to make
right,
the,
yeah,
the,
basically you
the
have,
analogy work, but it's
yeah,
not.
With amino acids, you have 20 different kinds of amino acids, and you can mix them in different combinations in a different sequence. Now, with baking, you know, the combinations matter, but the sequence necessarily doesn't matter. Here, there's actually a linear sequence that matters. But yeah, and you can tell, just like, you know, the ingredients going into different restaurants, maybe this is a good way of thinking about it. The ingredients that go into different restaurants, there's a lot of similarities, but the food that comes out of those restaurants is different, right? Some of them are Italian restaurants, some of them are, you know, Chinese restaurants, whatever. And so you'd identify different kinds of restaurants by the food coming out of it. But you can identify different kinds of cell types by the proteins that are coming out of them. Different cell types make different proteins. And some of those proteins stay inside the cell, and some of those proteins get put in the membrane of the cell so that they stick outside partly. And those proteins allow those cells to communicate with other cells, either directly by binding, so the protein in the membrane of one cell binds to the protein in the membrane of another cell, or one cell can release something like a cytokine that now floats out in the bloodstream or in, you know, outside of the cells in a tissue, an organ, and that cytokine can then bind to one of these proteins on the membrane of another cell, and those determine how they react, right? If you are a cell type that doesn't have the receptor on your membrane to bind to a particular kind of cytokine, you're not going to respond when that cytokine is floating around. And so that's how these different parts of the immune system get differentiated, why they have different functions, because they respond differently to different signals. They have the ability to recognize different kinds of signals. And so they can use this flow cytometry different fluorescent labels that match different of these membrane proteins to identify, okay, this, you know, there were so many of these cells that had proteins A, B, and C, and, you know, so many other cells that had proteins A, C, and F, and so forth in the different combinations. And so they're, you know, and so they feed these cells one at a time, and they go past a laser basically that can measure different things, how it responds to different wavelengths of light and so forth. And then they see what comes out as they shine a laser on different cells, and they can tell things about the size and the shape of the cell, and then what proteins are on the outside, depending on what fluorescent labels are on there. And so all of that allows them to build a profile of, okay, this is what your immune response looks like to this virus at, you know, so many days after infection. You have so many of cells expressing this protein and so many cells expressing that protein and so forth. And we know that this combination of proteins on a cell means it's a type 1 immune, you're having a type 1 immune system reaction and so forth. You can also look at the cytokines that are in the blood and see what kind of reaction you have. Different kinds of cytokines mean different type 1, type 2, type 3, and so forth, or you're still in the innate immune response. So that's what we're looking at. I'm not getting specifically into what's differentiating the different responses, but that's generally the kinds of differences they're looking for. And the hope is that by getting into a more granular picture of what actually is going on with the immune response of the different patients, that might inform therapies more directly. Right. So we've known for a while about the cytokine storm, and we've been trying to treat that with some sort of basic things like steroids that sort of work more broadly against the immune system to kind of tamp down the immune system. The trick with that is that if you dial it down too much too quickly, then the infection takes over because your immune system isn't keeping it in control. And so the idea with this is that, well, maybe instead of having to just give a broad acting steroid, we might be able to more finely tune, okay, we've measured something in about you, or we just know that you're this many days into the infection. We need to make sure that you're having an immune response that looks like this. And so we'll add a little bit of this cytokine, or we will give you a drug that blocks the action of that cytokine to make sure that we're regulating the immune reaction in a little bit more fine-tuned way.
That's pretty interesting.
Good.
I think we're probably at a point to kind of wrap up.
Yeah, I think we've covered all the things we'd prepared. So, yeah, thanks, everybody, for listening. Hope you found it interesting, too. And if you have questions that you'd like us to talk about, or comments or reactions or anything at all along those lines, you can get in contact. biobreakpod@gmail.com is our email. We're @biobreakpod on Twitter. And you can look up BioBreak on Facebook. And we hope to hear from you, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.
Bye.